Questioning Paul, Chapter 2, Part 7.
Incidentally, and forgetting about the divine placeholders for a moment, just because the Greek reads Isu Christou, that does not automatically mean that it is always appropriate to order the name and descriptive title this way in English. In Greek, like Hebrew and Latin, in fact in many languages, adjectives follow the nouns they are modifying. But in English the opposite is true. For example, the Hebrew reads Ruach Kodesh, but in English, it is written set apart spirit. But then at issue is whether Messiah is an adjective or a title, and if it is a title, why is the definite article routinely omitted? And also, since Paul has already deployed Satan's title, the Lord, writing the Lord Isu Christou, why is the improper title in the proper place but the proper title is not? Then, turning from the text to the religious translations of it, regardless as to whether it was deployed as an adjective or a title, why is Isu Christou, the lone exception, the only case where English translators failed to move adjectives, adverbs, and titles forward, so that they precede the nouns and verbs they are describing? Calling the Messiah Yahusha, Jesus Christ, is like writing James King, where King is inferred to be James' last name, instead of his title. And yet, it is hard to miss the possible intent and unavoidable consequence. The Messiah Yahusha became Jesus Christ, to Christians. You can be the judge as to whether this was incriminating or affirming.
For because currently and simultaneously, men I persuade, I presently, actively, and actually use words to win the favor of seducing, misleading, coaxing, convincing, appeasing, and placating, or alternatively, the God, or by comparison and contrast, I seek and desire to please and accommodate humans. Yet nevertheless, if men, I was pleasing and accommodating, exciting the emotions of and lifting up a slave of Christou, certainly not was me, 1 verse 10, but nevertheless, I profess, reveal, perceive, provide, and declare to you brothers of the beneficial messenger and healing message which having been communicated advantageously by, under, through, by reason of, because of, and controlled by myself, because it is not in accord with man, 1 verse 11, but neither because I by man associating myself with it, nor was I taught or instructed as a disciple, but to the contrary, by way of a revelation, an appearance serving to uncover and unveil Isu Christou, 1 verse 12.
Shaul's animosity toward the Torah began before his conversion. As a rabbinical student, he had been trained to argue against God, so Paulus wasn't so much addressing his former association with Judaism, but instead revealing the mindset which permeated his writings. Initially, at least before I discovered that each of the hundreds times Torah was written in Yahweh's word as a proper noun, that it was translated using nomos throughout every extant copy of the Septuagint, I was hopeful that by confessing his affinity for Judaism and the religion's oral traditions, Paul would associate his use of nomos with the Talmud instead of the Torah. But that did not happen, and it is not possible. While he knew the Talmud's oral laws like the back of his hand, Shaul never made the connection to rabbinic law, and he routinely associated the nomos he was assailing with Yahweh's Torah. Moreover, the notion of rendering nomos as anything other than Torah is torn asunder by Paul's own translation in Galatians 3 verse 10. So now, listen carefully to what he says.
For you heard of my behavior in some time and place in the practice of Judaism, namely that because throughout and accordingly showing superiority, surpassing any measure of restraint, I was aggressively and intensely pursuing the called out of God, and I wasn't am devastating her, continuing to annihilate her. Galatians 1 verse 13.
The Nestle-Allen's interlinear presents this same revolting palette of words using a slightly more sparse array of colors.
You heard for them my behavior then in the Judaism that by excess I was pursuing the assembly of the God and was ravaging her.
The King James Version helped fan the flames of anti-Semitism by combining Jews' religion, and beyond measure I'd persecuted the Church of God.
For ye have heard of my conversation in time past in the Jews' religion, how that beyond measure I persecuted the Church of God, and wasted it.
What's interesting here is that there is actually no basis for or indication of a conversion in Paul's letter, and the British can't blame the Roman for this Christianity's deadly opposition to Judaism. The Vulgate's rendering was somewhat more accurate. Jerome's Latin translation reads,
"For you have heard of my former behavior with the Nihilismo, that, beyond measure, I persecuted the Ecclesia and fought against her."
But here again, while former is a superior rendering of that than is conversion, it isn't accurate. It speaks of any place and time, of some place and time, of an undisclosed point in the past, present, or future, and is, therefore, by no means limited to a former time. This is not a minor point, because Paul specifically used the imperfect tense in association with Portheo to say that he had and was continuing to ravage and destroy those who have chosen to be with God. He never stopped attacking. The New Living Translation turned back the clock even further on truth by completely ignoring that, by rendering a ecclesia church, and by failing to communicate the ongoing nature of the final imperfect verb.
You know what I was like when I followed the Jewish religion, how I violently persecuted God's church. I did my best to destroy it.
God has a lot of things, but church is not among them. In this passage, Shaul wasn't putting himself in opposition to Judaism, nor suggesting that he was no longer practicing the religion, but instead was stating that the Jewish religion was in opposition to God's people. In fact, later in Acts, before a Jewish assembly, Paul will speak of Judaism as if it remained the love of his life. And yet throughout this letter, and in others, his comments are decidedly anti-Semitic, fueling the animosity Christians would harbor against Jews. This duplicity is an enigma unless perceived from the perspective that Paul wanted to be seen as both in league with and in opposition to everyone and everything. And there is no question that Shaul wasn't continued to be religious. It is therefore instructive to know that Judaismos is based upon Judaizo, which in turn is defined as the adoption of Jewish customs, traditions and religious rites, even the observation of the ritual law. Thereby Judaismos describes rabbinic Judaism. Being a fundamentalist practitioner of Judaism made Shaul opposed to a redeeming Messiah, to a suffering servant, as opposed to a conquering warrior, but that still does not explain his unbridled animosity toward those who quietly elected to follow him. Judaism, unlike Islam, indeed even unlike Christianity, has never inspired rage. From the religion's fledgling beginnings circa 200 BCE to the present day, Jews have fought 6 defensive campaigns, the first 3 of which failed, all hoping to liberate their homeland from invaders. The Greeks once, the Romans twice, and more recently on 3 occasions against Muslims. The religion isn't sufficiently aggressive or violent to inspire the kind of rage Shaul expressed. Nor is there any evidence to suggest that Shaul was anything more than a lone wolf, singularly vicious and out of control. This is the second time Paul has revealed that his cravings were insatiable. First it was libertine lusts, sexual perversions, which he blamed on the Torah. And now he is attributing his unrestrained annihilation of passive and peaceful people on his religion. And yet, lost in his arrogance, he wants us to believe that he alone was selected by God to slander him and undermine his Torah. But I know someone similarly perverted and violent, Muhammad. His bloodlust and appetite for sexual abuse were hallmarks of his life, where terrorism was used to supply an endless stream of booty and babes. His religion grew out of his lust. Paul's may have as well. As we consider Paulus's claim, I'd be surprised if more than a handful of people, most of whom would have been relatives of his victims, would have heard of him. I suspect that Shaul was a legend in his own mind. And the evidence indicates that Judaism wasn't responsible for his actions. There is no historic evidence to suggest that others were operating similarly. There is no record of such orders in any rabbinic archive, and you'd be hard-pressed to find any group more committed to documenting their aims and arguments. That may be one of many reasons that Paulus provided no specificity with regard to time or place. And if you are wondering why he would admit these awful things, especially if they were exaggerated, it is because he thought that the comparison between the old Shawl and new Paulus would serve to demonstrate the relative merits of the old system compared to his New Testament. The same strategy is deployed in Islam, which is why I recognize the ploy. And while these are all serious and deeply troubling issues, they don't measure up to juxtaposing hyperbole, showing superiority surpassing any measure of restraint, Dioko, aggressively and intensely pursuing, and Porphyo, devastating and annihilating, especially when scribed in the imperfect and directed at God's children. Had Paulus wanted to say that he had been conceited, that he had been out of control and intensely aggressive in the past while annihilating, which is to murder in mass, God's covenant children, he would have used the perfect tense, which describes actions which were completed in the past which lead to the present state of affairs. The fact he didn't, not only confirms that his assault on the covenant was ongoing, indeed never-ending, but also that he had no respect for his audience, believing that they were so inferior to his intellect that they'd never figure it out no matter how obvious he made it for them. We don't know all of the details of Shaul's life. He told us that he studied to be a rabbi, but we don't know for certain if he never became one. As a young man, he claims to have studied under the famed Gamaliel, which would have put him in Jerusalem while Yahusha was there. But an undisclosed time thereafter he claims to have been making tents back in his hometown of Tarsus, in what is now southwestern Turkey. So since there is no shortage of rabbis in Jerusalem to harass the followers of the way, should that have been their unofficial mission, why recruit a vicious and egotistical and bridled libertine? That makes no sense, unless, of course, Shaul was so immoral, myopic, and uniquely savage that he became an ideal candidate for all of the wrong reasons. But even then, how depraved would an individual have to be to engage in a mission where the goal was to mercilessly bludgeon your own people, ripping innocent families apart who had broken no laws, only because you disagreed with their conclusions? A moral and rational individual could never have done such a thing. So since Shaul has confessed to all of these acts and attributes, and since the attitude required to actually have done these horrendous things permeates this letter, it is incumbent upon us to consider the character flaws which motivated him. Returning to the passage itself, the Ekklesia, describing those who were called out of the world and unto God, is a translation of the Hebrew Kara, itself the basis of Mikra, the title of Yahweh's seven invitations to be called out and meet with him. It is telling that the Ekklesia is feminine. This is because it represents Yahweh's Bereth, covenant, also feminine, and because inclusion in it is facilitated by the Ruach Kodesh, set-apart spirit, the feminine manifestation of God's nature. Beyond this, Yisrael, like Bereth, Ekklesia, and Ruach, is feminine, with the first two representing Yahweh's bride at least symbolically. Before the divorce decree was announced through the prophet Hosea based upon Yisrael's infidelity, the familial covenant relationship was a monogamous marriage between Yahweh and his chosen people. But when God's bride chose to cavort with Baal, the Lord, in Hebrew, Yahweh announced the divorce, a split which he has promised to resolve on the day of reconciliations 2,000 years after he healed the rift with Yahusha's and the set-apart spirit's fulfillment of the first four Micrae. In so doing, Yahweh honored each of the five promises he had made to his covenant children, with our spiritual mother enriching and empowering the Ekklesia, called out, on Shavuot, 7 Sabbaths. And it have been on this Micra, after tangibly demonstrating the purpose of Passover, unyeasted bread, and first fruits on the way out of Egypt, that the Torah was revealed to God's children. It is another connection Christians seldom acknowledge. Sir Francis Bacon, the occultist that King James, as he was then known, most likely hired to shepherd his self-serving translation, in addition to the politically savvy theologians who served with him, must have felt that since the opening verb of Galatians 1 verse 13 was "you heard," they have liberty to change wayward behavior to conversation. After all, they could be pretty sure Paulus wasn't going to object. And I suppose it sounded more racist to say the Jews' religion, rather than Judaism, which explains that decision as well. But no matter what their justification may have been for copy-editing Shaul, as a consequence of replacing Ecclesia, called out, with Church, the lone aspect of the message which had any merit was lost, and a devastating misnomer was born. While I have attempted to hold Shaul, himself, accountable for the severe character flaws required to perpetrate savagery on innocent kin, he must also bear the burden of his legacy. His positioning of Judaism as a ruthless enemy of God's Church has fanned the flames of racial hatred and caused horrible and needless suffering. Translations exacerbated the problem, to be sure, but it was Paul who presented Judaism as the enemy of his faith, Christianity. The foreseeable and inevitable consequence was to rally Christians to persecute Jews out of a misguided sense of divine retribution. This is a glaring red flag, a dire warning signal, a dead canary in the coal mine, which most have missed. Satan's religions engender a hatred for Yahweh's chosen people. In the Torah we read,
"For you are a set apart people unto Yahweh, your God. Yahweh, your God, has chosen you to be a people for himself, a treasured possession above all of the peoples on the face of the earth." Deuteronomy 7 verse 6.
God's love for his people is unmistakable and unshakable, but so is Shaul's animosity. The Babylonians and Assyrians, as the first practitioners of satanic sun god religious schemes, were especially savage toward Jews, or correctly, Yahudim, meaning related to Yahweh, plundering their towns and hauling the people off into slavery. The Egyptians, who practiced the same religion under different names, held the Israelites captive for 4 centuries. Again changing the names but still practicing the same religion, the Seleucid Grecian Empire, which was created as a result of Alexander's conquests, ruthlessly sacked Jerusalem under Antiochus IV Epiphanes, the manifestation of God, as is described in the books of Maccabees. The Romans, who worshipped the same gods, but also under different names, were perhaps even more barbaric in their treatment of Jews than were the Babylonians and Assyrians. They razed Yahweh's home, salted Yahudah so that nothing would grow, and then renamed the promised land Philistina, solely because the Torah presents the Philistines as Israel's most annoying enemy. From whence we get the myth of a Palestinian people. Constantine's Christians, governed as they were by Pauline doctrine, were so anti-Jewish, observing any aspect of Yahweh's Torah became a crime punishable by death. Then came Islam, a religion born out of plundering, enslaving, raping, and murdering Jews en masse. But they were not alone. Such discrimination and lack of moral judgment lingered throughout the reign of Catholicism in Europe, facilitating the horrid treatment of Yahweh's chosen people under the dominion of the first socialist secular humanist regimes, Hitler's Germany and Stalin's Russia. The common denominator manifest in each of these religions, including the faith conceived by Shaul, is a ruthless animosity directed at God's covenant children, especially those who were naturally born, Israel and Yahudim. It is Satan's trademark. It is why Yahweh predicted that the serpent would bruise the heel of man. Jacob, who was named Israel by Yahweh, is based upon the Hebrew word for heel. Therefore, Shaul's animosity toward God's chosen people should have been seen as a red flag of monumental proportions, displaying the kind of arrogance that is the hallmark of the most grossly insecure individuals. Shaul continued to brag. But rather than isolate his next statement from his previous one, let's join them because one flows out of the other. And as you read these words, please note that the selection of the imperfect tense, which made Paul's last statement so indicting and devastating, is manifest again in his follow-on comments, thereby conveying 2 things. First, Paul is suggesting that Judaism was the cause of his bloody rampage. And second, he is saying that he is still progressing in the religion.
"For because indeed you heard of my wayward behavior in some time and place in the practice of Judaism, namely that because throughout, showing superiority, surpassing any measure of restraint, to an extraordinary degree, and better than anyone else, I was aggressively and intensely pursuing, hastily striving toward, persecuting, oppressing, and harassing the cold out of God, and I wasn't am devastating her, continuing to undermine, overthrow, and annihilate her. 1 verse 13, and so I wasn't continue to progress in the practice of Judaism, over and beyond many contemporaries among my race, excessively enthusiastic to belong to the traditions and teachings handed down by my forefathers. Galatians 1 verse 14.
First things first. By successively deploying the imperfect tense, Paulus has left no doubt that his unrestrained and depraved behavior and his participation in this degenerate religion were not limited to the past experiences, but was an ongoing devotion. He was and would continue to be a religiously inspired assassin. And indeed, Paul morphed many of the worst characteristics of Judaism into Christianity, thereby spreading its devastating consequences from the few to many, from Yahudim to Gaudim. This confession means that there was no conversion experience on the road to Damascus. Paulus is what Shaul was. Nothing changed. He did not progress from attacking God's covenant children to nurturing them, from rabbinical traditions to the Christian religion. If, as Yahweh asserts, it was Satan under the guise and moniker of the Lord who had influenced the Israelites to oppose his Torah and to reject his covenant in favor of their oral traditions, then as Shaul will later admit, it was the same spirit who appealed to the founder of the Christian religion on the road to Damascus. In his opposition to God, Paulus would display the same attitude and approach now manifest throughout the Talmud. And he was just like the authors of Jewish traditions who, while claiming to speak for God, did the opposite. Likewise, and in the manner of the rabbis, Shaul's characterization of the Messiah would bear no resemblance to most of the promises made about him in the Torah or prophets. The Christian Christ, like the rabbinic Meshach, would be estranged from Yahweh, and most penalizing of all, there would be no connection between the Messiah and his fulfillment of the Micra in the Talmud or these epistles. Also, as was the case with the rabbis, Paulus would deploy arguments which made his testimony, at least in the eyes of his adherents, more relevant than, even vastly superior to, God's. To this day, religious Jews hold their Talmud over the Torah, just as every religious Christian values their New Testament, comprised chiefly of Paul's letters, over the Word of God, and most especially over his Torah. Nothing changed except the audience. In these words, Shaul has conveyed and indeed embraced the rabbinical mindset, defining what it means to be an adherent of Judaism. The religion was conceived to zealously incorporate and integrate every descendant of Jacob so that each and every religious Jew would have their lives defined and governed by these oral traditions. Christianity has had a very similar influence on Gentiles, with nations, communities, and cultures for vast swaths of time often being indistinguishable from the religion. While we shouldn't have been surprised, the Greek word designating the religious teaching and traditions of Shaul's elders, paradisis, also means to surrender, to give up, and to deliver oneself into the hands of others. It is based upon paradidomi, whose tertiary definition after surrender, and to be delivered into custody, is to be judged, condemned, punished, put to death, and be anguished as a result of treachery. The fourth connotation conveys to be taught in such a way as to be molded as a result of verbal reports. In the realm of etymology, this is especially revealing because it exposes the cause and consequence of religious traditions and teachings. Therefore, so has Paul. He loved his religion. He just hated his people. They would not honor him the way Gentiles have done. With regard to Shaul's affinity for Judaism, please consider this confession. Having climbed some stairs to rise above his audience, motioning for them to be silent, and then speaking in Hebrew, Shaul proclaimed, "Men, brothers and fathers, you must listen to me, to this regarding and against you, the current and present defense and justification." Acts 22 verse 1. As is the case throughout Paul's letters, he is defending and justifying his credentials and message, not Yahweh's or Yahusha's. It is a broken record figuratively and literally. Rather than encouraging us to listen to God, Shaul is demanding that we listen to him. Then rather than tell the uplifting story of Yahusha, of Nazareth, The troubled true butter continued to tout Shaul from Tarsus, and then having heard that the Hebrew language he had been and was continuing to use to address them, the more they continued to be quiet, and he declares, Acts 22 verse 2. This serves as one of several indications that the conversations later recorded in Greek throughout the so-called Christian New Testament were originally spoken in Hebrew, the language of Yahweh and heaven. Therefore, any name or concept derived from Greek rather than Hebrew should be discarded, inclusive of religious perversions. This includes Jesus, Christ, Christian, Gospel, Cross, Church, Grace, Resurrection, Religion, Obedience, Worship, Holy, Hell, and Angels, in addition to Peter, Paul, John, James, and Matthew, in addition to Jew among the list of invalid names and corrupt concepts. Since there is no support for the following in the Greek text, Christmas, Easter, and Sunday as the Lord's Day, as well as the Eucharist, Communion, and the Trinity were derived from the pagan religious practices of Babylon, Egypt, Greece, and Rome, and therefore cannot be blamed on Christianity's New Testament. Shaul then admitted,
I am a Jewish man, having been born in Tarsus of Cilicia, but then and now having been reared, nourished, and educated in this city alongside the feet of Gamaliel, having been educated and trained with regards to the most perfect and strictest conformity to, being absolutely accurate in exacting accord with the forefathers' apportionment which was received, was zealous, enthusiast and ardent, present and existing of God, according to and in the same proportion degree as all of you. Acts 22 verse 3.
This single proclamation contains several exceptionally inappropriate statements. This man, who claimed to speak for the Messiah Yahusha, wallowed in the idea of being educated and trained by a rabbi, the leader of those Yahusha, had said were born of serpents. It would have been one thing for him to admit in passing that he had once been one of Gamaliel's students, but it's another altogether to speak of this acclaimed rabbi as if he was filling the role of the set-apart spirit. It is obvious that Paul admired a man Yahusha would have despised. The problem Yahusha had with rabbinical traditions, known as the Oral Torah, later codified in the Talmud, is that it changes, corrupts, counterfeits, and conceals Yahweh's actual Torah teaching. So why did Paul call the inheritance which was received from his forefathers precisely accurate, when Yahusha said the opposite? And speaking of perfect, Shaul used the perfect tense with reference to the training he had received from Gamaliel, saying that while his education was complete, it had lingering effects. Therefore, we must ask, why did Shaul claim to be a religious fundamentalist, to be a zealot in strict conformity with that which was parceled out by his forefathers? This question is vital because it also suggests that Paul was either a compulsive liar who cannot be trusted, or he never converted from Judaism to Christianity, not that one was better than the other. Further, based upon this statement, since Shaul claimed to be in absolute accord with Judaism and its oral traditions, the argument cannot be made that he was assailing the Talmud instead of the Torah throughout his letters. Also, Paul will twice attest that he had not been taught by man, and yet now when it suits him to gain credibility with this audience, he is admitting to have received training from the most acclaimed religious scholar of his day. So was he lying then or now? This is one of the few times Shaul specifically identifies whether it was Yahweh's Torah that he was addressing or the religious traditions of the Jews. And it is one of the few times he speaks favorably of the text. For those who know and love Yahweh, this juxtaposition is sufficient to demean and discount everything Shaul wrote and said. Reinforcing this reality, by placing Nama amongst qualifiers such as the teaching of the Jewish religious scholar Gamaliel, rabbinical training, conformity, being a fundamentalist, adhering to the traditions of the forefathers, and being a zealous enthusiast, the Torah, Shaul was declaring his loyalty to had to be rabbinic, and thus could not have been Yahweh's Torah. So when we are finally given some clarity, the picture being presented is the antithesis of the one painted by God set into the context of his overt animosity for Yahweh's word, This is especially a Pauling. It's becoming apparent through his testimony that Paul upped the religious law Yahweh and Yahusha, despised, and hated the Torah Yahweh and Yahusha, loved. And perhaps that was why he so seldom differentiates between them in Galatians. If he had made his allegiance this obvious in his initial letters, his message would have been summarily rejected by all those who actually knew Yahusha. In this regard, it should be noted that of the 219 times the Hebrew word Torah, meaning teaching, direction, guidance, and instruction, is found as a proper noun in Yahweh's word, in the Greek Septuagint translation of it, Torah was rendered nomos, meaning an allocation of inheritance which is parceled out, each and every time. Recognizing, therefore, the enormity of the Septuagint's influence on the Greek texts which comprise the so-called Christian New Testament, a statement including nomos must reference unequivocal modifiers, such as are evident here in Acts, to render nomos as anything other than Yahweh's Torah. So throughout this book, unless the context dictates otherwise, we will continue to default to Torah when nomos is found in the Greek text. There is no other informed or rational option. Addressing Shawal's concluding comment.
Present and existing of God.
While religions such as Judaism, while religious leaders such as Gamaliel, and while religious traditions and customs such as those manifest in the oral traditions now found in the Talmud, seek to nourish a zealousness for God, their God isn't Yahweh. The religious God is a false deity modeled after the men who conceived him. Some 15 paragraphs ago I suggested that Shaul became pious and sought the acclaim of Gentiles largely because his own people refused to believe him. Already prone to anger, he became enraged. So should you want additional proof that Shaul despised Yahweh's chosen people, consider these impassioned words from his second letter, where he rails against his race for doing what he himself had done.
You suffered, and under your own countrymen, just as also themselves under the Jews, the ones having killed the Lord as sound and the prophets, and having pursued and persecuted us, not pleasing God and hostile adversaries against all men, hindering us as we speak to the races so that they might be delivered, for they are filled to capacity with continuous and eternal sins. So upon them is furious indignation and wrathful judgment unto the end of time. 1 Thessalonians 2:14-16.
If this unjustified and unbridled religious rant doesn't bother you, you can't be bothered. An entire book could be written about the many ways this is wrong. Woven as it was on a single thread of truth, this repositioning of Yahweh's chosen people as being permanently disinherited, and as being the enemy of all humankind, as being completely evil, has the adversary's fingerprints all over it. But at the very least, consider this. Was Shaul not a Jew? Returning to Galatians 1:14, the Nestle-Allen's interlinear conveyed Paul's arrogance thusly.
And I was progressing in the Judaism beyond many contemporaries in the kind of me more exceedingly jealous existing of the fathers of me traditions. Plus so it isn't that the King James is wrong, albeit it is poorly worded, but that it is inadequate, saying.
And profited in the Jews' religion above many my equals in my known nation, being more exceedingly zealous of the traditions of my fathers.
Jerome did the passage justice, however. In the LV he wrote,
and I advanced in the Judaism beyond many of my equals among my own kind, having proven to be more abundant in zeal toward the traditions of my fathers.
Under Philip Comfort's guidance, the .New Living Translation suggested,
I was far ahead of my fellow Jews in my zeal for the traditions of my ancestors.
It is as if the authors of the New Living Translation felt compelled to change even the simplest messages. Judaismos describes Judaism the practice of the Jewish religion. It isn't the Greek word for Jew. Judaism is a religion. Jews are a race. The difference is gargantuan. Shaul's next statement is also untrue, feeding the myth of predestination and the mythos which became Calvinism. And speaking of mistakes, you should note that the independent clause depicted within the brackets below isn't included in the text of Papyrus 46. The oldest extant witness of this letter.
But at a point in time it pleased for God, the one having appointed me, setting me aside out of the womb of my mother, 1 verse 15, to reveal and disclose the Son of Him in order that I could announce the healing message and beneficial messenger among the races and nations, immediately. I did not ask the advice of or consult with flesh or blood. Galatians 1 verse 15 to 16.
Unpolished in the Nestle Allen's interlinear, Paul's words as he wrote them, read.
When but thought well the God the one having separated me from stomach of mother of me and having called through the favor of him to uncover the son of him and me that I might tell good message him and the nations immediately not I conferred in flesh and blood.
End of part 7.